This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Saturday edition of the Best of Fight Back from the week that was. Is it possible that U.S. President Joe Biden struck a blow against the ageism that surrounds him? His strong performance in the State of the Union address on March 7th in a feisty and lengthy speech allayed, or should have allayed, a lot of concerns about whether he is still with it. Libby discussed Joe Biden's State of the Union performance with our Zoomer squad. John Wright is Executive Vice President of Maru Public Opinion. Anthony Quinn is Chief Community Officer at CARP, A New Vision of Aging. And Rudy Butignol is CARP's President.
I was impressed. You know, the key issue was his ability to speak and think. And I think he did all those things. I think he was really full of piss and vinegar. I think he was sharp, was feisty, as you mentioned. And he was able to deal with the hecklers in the crowd. You know, so I think he was with it. He wasn't just reading off the teleprompter. I think he did what he needed to do for the people that are open to considering the possibilities.
I thought the bar was set very low for Joe Biden. All he had to do was not have a train wreck like he had the month earlier when the special counsel had called him a well-meaning elderly old man with a poor memory. So he was trying to change the tune on that impression of him and deliver a speech for an hour from a teleprompter. So the bar was low. There was no train wreck, as I think the nation was tuning in to watch. But he's got a number of months to continue to prove that he can do that on the campaign trail, and that's yet to be seen.
Well, they're both elderly candidates in the United States, Trump and Biden. They're in their senior years, and when Biden went off the teleprompter, he was able to engage with the audience. He was sharp and everything. And when I see Donald Trump doing the same thing and he goes off the teleprompter, he's incoherent.
But he's always been that way.
Yeah, but so it's amazing that it's not really – they're speaking to the converted, obviously, in many ways. It's the – I guess it's the independents, the people that are open to thinking, like, which candidate am I going to vote for? That's who this is to appeal to.
Yeah, the big problem is, in the conversation I hear, particularly on the pundits in the U.S., is they're confusing competence with age. And they will say, is he too old to govern, or is Trump too old? And the question should certainly be about their competence to govern, regardless of their age. And that's where we fall into that discrimination, the age discrimination line. If we're talking about someone purely based on their age and not their skill set or their ability, that's when we're in discrimination territory.
Have you seen any evidence that the whole age issue surrounding Biden has eased since his State of the Union speech?
It hasn't changed a bit. I mean, the only people that surprised that night were the media, the New York Post, who posted the next day, he's alive, and people in the White House who basically, you know, held their breath while the commander-in-chief went out and took the stage. Look, in politics, it's not one night that makes it. And the reality is, in politics nowadays, social media, advertising, you know, directly to people, causes people to, I mean, there's that phrase, paint somebody's wagon before they get a chance to paint your own. This is being painted for some time. I mean, Joe Biden's coming out. We saw him the next day out at another function. It may be energizing some Democrats over it, but I think in the short term it hasn't done anything, nor will it.
I mean, I would assume that most people didn't even watch the speech, but certainly listened to the spin on it from their own camp, right, John?
I mean, I'm sure all of us would have stuck around for a 2.5-hour speech if the Prime Minister had made it, right? Not at all. I mean, you know, and then he hung around the chamber for another hour. I mean, he showed that he wasn't old. But, Libby, you and I and all of us here have been around politics to know that he had a good night because he came out feisty. And the next morning he jumped off a plane step and went to another rally, and he was feisty there. But I mean, honestly, for the last year, he's been, you know, portrayed as a doddering, old, stuttering man. Like, that's how he has been portrayed versus his rival that, regardless of what you think of him, is energetic every day at the podium and saying all kinds of stuff. So the contrast is not going to be erased in one 24-hour span. The polling that took place the night was the dial polling, where you get Republicans, Democrats, and Independents to kind of look at this stuff. And yeah, it had a bump, but you can't erase 6 months of intense advertising, especially to, as you rightly pointed out, a very polarized audience that, you know, comes down to seven states at the end of the night by a thin margin who's going to win the presidency. So I don't think it had much of an impact at all.
John Wright, Executive Vice President of Maru Public Opinion. Anthony Quinn, Chief Community Officer of CARP, A New Vision of Aging. And Rudy Butignol, CARP's President. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. It was a late Friday afternoon announcement a week ago yesterday. Minister of International Development Ahmed Hussein announced that Canada is resuming funding to the UN Palestinian Relief Agency, UNRWA, despite the fact that the investigation they originally said they were waiting for is not complete. Earlier, the Trudeau Liberals announced they were suspending funding after Israel alleged and provided evidence that some UNRWA employees participated in the October 7th terror attacks on southern Israel. Libby pointed out on Monday that this all seems like a charade because Canada made an early payment to UNRWA before announcing the suspension and now is set to make another payment. So, in effect, Canadian taxpayers never stopped funding the organization. Israel's ambassador to Canada says he was surprised by Ottawa's decision to continue funding UNRWA. Joining Libby to discuss, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, Vivian Berkovich.
I think that, in fact, Canada, the EU announced that they were resuming funding, and about 30 seconds later, Canada jumped in as well. As soon as somebody else did it, Canada was going to jump in. But as you pointed out, and I'm so glad you did, Canada never actually suspended funding. They made a payment of some $23 million that was not due until April, early, months early. That's unheard of. Like, that never happens in the world of international aid. And they actually made that payment. And then Hussein came out and said, oh, we're pausing our payments to UNRWA, which was a complete falsehood. And not only that, but a few days after that announcement, he came out and said, oh, and we're adding another $40 million to various organizations on the ground, like World Food Program and a few others. But the fact is that they contract with UNRWA because they actually don't have the capability, the operational ability to distribute the aid in Gaza. So it was cheeky of Hussein, but he and his people surely knew that World Food, Red Cross, and any other groups to whom they donated money for the Gaza Strip was going to then be subcontracted to UNRWA.
What were they trying to signal by announcing that they were pausing funding, even if they didn't? What was the point of that?
Oh, that was just kind of, you know, everybody else in the West had expressed outrage about a bunch of things that had been exposed. And so, you know, they don't really act on principle. So they just did it to sort of look like they were in line with other Western countries. That's what I take out of it. That's how I understand it. But, you know, you mentioned in the opening that, you know, there were quite a number of UNRWA employees who were shown without a doubt to have participated in the October 7th massacre and subsequently. So, you know, UNRWA employees, including a teacher and a physician and others, have imprisoned civilian hostages in their homes. They have tortured them. They have starved them. But there's more to it than that, because the UNRWA hospitals and schools were all hosting Hamas tunnels, weapons storage. I mean, there's so much evidence supporting these claims. But then the really big kind of, you know, bang came when UNRWA headquarters in southern Gaza, in Rafah, the city where the last sort of power of Hamas is centered now. Their headquarters there, turns out, sat atop what they call a server farm. which is like this huge kind of, you know, computer control hub for Hamas. And I mean, all these cables and wires and all kinds of crazy stuff was using UNRWA power. And, you know, and you can see it coming up through the floor. And UNRWA, the head of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, said, I had no idea, which was a complete lie. And that's when the West really went kind of apoplectic.
Well,
on the funding
we
thing.
Have seen, Vivian, pictures of all of this.
Yes.
So how can anyone throw, I mean, I understand there has to be a formal investigation, but we have seen this. And even there are some people who say, well, UNRWA doesn't have any choice. If they want to operate there, they have to make nice with Hamas. But, I mean, there can't be much doubt about this.
Yeah. So, first of all, it's one thing to kind of make nice and cooperate. It's another to be completely co-opted by. And this has been going on for like two decades now, almost two decades in the Gaza Strip, but decades elsewhere. So there's no separation between Hamas and UNRWA in the Gaza Strip. But, you know, many of the offensive things that we can now prove about UNRWA and Hamas have also been ongoing in the West Bank. It's not a huge difference, you know, when you look at some of the activities of the Palestinian Authority. These are very corrupt, authoritarian, and deeply anti-Semitic organizations, not just anti-Israel. They hate Jews. So, I mean, for anyone to sort of pretend that they didn't know is a farce.
Vivian Berkovich, a former Canadian ambassador to Israel. You're listening to The Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, have you adjusted to that lost hour of sleep yet? We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Have you felt more tired than usual this past week? We lost an hour of sleep when we turned the clocks forward a week ago. And now the debate about whether the twice-a-year time changes are good or bad continues. On the negative side, with the return of daylight saving time, there is evidence of more car crashes and increased risk of heart attacks. On the positive, we get another hour of daylight in the evening. Two experts joined Libby on Monday to discuss. Dr. Michael Antal is professor of psychology at the University of Calgary. And Dr. Patricia Lakin-Thomas is associate professor in the Department of Biology at York University.
I think we're getting increasing evidence every year. Just a few years ago, frankly, I was a bit skeptical that there was much going on. But I think every year there are more studies coming out telling us about the negative effects, certainly of the spring forward. The fall back in the fall doesn't seem to have quite as big an impact, but the scientific community has come to a consensus about this, that this is not a good idea to be doing it every year.
What is some of the key evidence?
We see increased rates of short-term effects in the spring forward. As you said, increased car accidents, heart attacks, workplace injuries, strokes, and even a report that judges give harsher sentences for a few days right after the time change.
Probably some people might think that's a good thing.
Well, not everybody agrees with that. So we're losing an hour of sleep, and we're also feeling a bit jet-lagged because our body clocks are now out of step with the sun time by an hour.
The big thing, I think a lot of people talk about this, is losing an hour of sleep, but then that happened. I think we all lost an hour last night, but it's actually going to take us quite a while. You mentioned a week. It could be longer than that for some people, might be a little shorter, because actually, as Pat just said, our body clocks are out of sync, so it's every day we've got to get up an hour earlier than our body clock is ready for, and it's not until dawn gets back to the right time for our body clock that we're going to start feeling better. So for some people, that could be a couple weeks. It's going to be about 4 weeks before dawn gets back to where it was on Saturday morning before we did this time change. And we know that with later sunsets, people tend to stay up later. We don't go to bed as early, and we still have to get up and go to work on time. So one of the big consequences of being on the wrong time is that we're actually sleeping less, and that adds up to over 100 hours less sleep over the whole year for people who are experiencing sunsets that are an hour later, and that can have serious health consequences from being chronically out of sync with the right time. So there's higher rates of obesity that go along with that, and heart disease and diabetes, and even some cancer rates go up with less sleep.
Is there an issue with the best kind of sleep, the REM sleep? Is that what people are losing?
I think it's just the overall sleep, the total amount of sleep that you're getting. It's usually the deep sleep in the early night that we really need that's restorative. But we also need just the total amount of sleep to really do all that restoration and cleaning up the toxic waste, et cetera, in our brains and reforming our synapses so we can learn and consolidate what we learned. And it's a total amount of sleep that we need, really. I'm not sure. Mike, maybe you know REM versus non-REM deep sleep.
Deep sleep is the one that your body will make up first if you've had a bad night's sleep. So the body wants that. But as Pat said, you really do need enough sleep. And even if you get half an hour too little every night, that adds up. And that's why people like to sleep in on the weekends, is to catch up on that sleep debt that they've been accumulating all week long.
What most jurisdictions have done is say, let's go to year-round daylight saving time. They think it would be great to have that extra hour of sun in the afternoon all year round. And daylight saving time, which we call summertime, sounds wonderful. Let's do summer all winter, like it's going to be warm and sunny in January, which it isn't. We're not saving any daylight. We're just shifting it later. It sounds great. The legislation in the U.S. is called the Sunshine Protection Act. Well, who doesn't want to protect sunshine? It has good press, but that's the wrong way to go. And what the scientific consensus is that we should be going to year-round standard time instead, ditch the changes and go to standard time. Ontario voted for daylight saving time year-round, but not until neighboring jurisdictions also agree. So it's ready to be triggered if the neighboring jurisdictions go to year-round daylight saving time, but that's the wrong direction.
Dr. Patricia Lakin-Thomas, Associate Professor, Department of Biology at York University, and Dr. Michael Antle, Professor of Psychology at the University of Calgary. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. It was supposed to quell speculation and conspiracy theories about the health of Kate, the Princess of Wales. But the smiley family photo released for British Mother's Day last weekend has done the opposite. Major news agencies pulled it, apparently after noticing multiple anomalies caused by photoshopping. Kate later issued an apology, saying that just like other amateur photographers, she sometimes dabbles in editing, but saying sorry actually made things worse, and all this may impact trust in any news that comes out about the royal family. On Tuesday, Libby was joined for a discussion with two royal experts. Leanne Delap is a Toronto-based freelance fashion and culture writer and frequent contributor to Zoomer magazine. And Richard Berthelsen is a royal commentator and expert in contemporary Canadian protocol and ceremony.
Well, of course, this has been a huge story on the front pages of UK press now for about 3 days, you know, starting with the photo itself and then the pulling of the photo and now the response to the photo. Whether it goes on beyond that is going to be an open question. It's interesting to me, public opinion polling in the United Kingdom suggests that most Brits, you know, feel that the princess is owed a little bit of privacy and can kind of tell us what she thinks. She wants to tell us about her health. And, a lot of comments I see from individuals is they don't totally understand the issue because they themselves probably Photoshop some family pics as well. Of course, there are some big issues with the dealing of the media and the credibility of the palace with the media. And the photo services that have made this decision. And those are very significant issues for the palace to navigate going forward.
They have a lot of staffers. Surely somebody looks at a photo before it's released as an official photo. Did they not notice?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the Kensington Palace has a separate press operation to Buckingham Palace. And it's really interesting. Buckingham Palace with the king, you know, got the media to come in and take a photo of him prior to Commonwealth Day and do the filming of the message. So that was a media-created image. This is in a very different area. And, you know, the princess herself and the Prince of Wales, William and Catherine, made a decision fairly early on that a lot of family occasions, they were going to provide their own picture to the media from their, and Catherine herself, you know, likes to dabble in photography. So there's every evidence to suggest that this has happened before, that they've done some modifications to photos because they saw them as family snaps and they wanted to get the best picture of their children. It wasn't really an issue. In yesterday's and Sunday's situation, much different thing because of the level of interest in her health and how she looks. So I think that they maybe kind of got complacent in how this has happened in the past. I think it was also striking that the apology came from the princess herself rather than staff. So I think that tells you a little bit about something about who thought this was a good idea.
One thing I haven't heard mentioned, and I know, Leanne, you are a tall person, but it looks to me the way it's done, I mean, how long are her arms, the way they had the arms? And then there's also more conspiracy that the picture of the princess's face is actually from an old Vogue shoot.
Well, you know what? Honestly, I think this is just such a huge PR mess, and they've really hit it into their own goal here, because PR is a game of setting the narrative, and so they've set everything back so far. As somebody who worked at a fashion magazine, I was an editor of a fashion magazine in the early 2000s when digital media was just on the rise, and suddenly everybody was a Photoshop expert, and you started to be able to not trust everything. That's why I think it's so important that that news agencies and newspapers have stood up to this and looked at, you know, the 20 different problems on the photo and said, we can't run this.
I don't think that people are really way off base when they say, it looks like that medical issue was worse than the palace seemed to let on. Leanne?
I do really believe that she has a right to medical privacy. But at the same time, with King Charles also out of commission, it's become this huge story. And I don't know, how much does the public have a right to know if you're a taxpayer? She's not in the line of succession. Is that fair? But at the same time, people who do share information about their medical journeys, we found that it's been so helpful to everybody out there. So there are two sides to that.
Leanne Delap, a Toronto-based freelance fashion and culture writer and frequent contributor to Zoomer magazine. And Richard Berthelsen, royal commentator and expert in contemporary Canadian protocol and ceremony. You're listening to The Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Still to come, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics. And we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Kathy in Niagara phoned about whether she thinks age is a factor in this year's U.S. presidential election.
I just think it comes down to the guy. Like, I don't care how old Trump is. He's an idiot. He should be in jail now instead of running for president. You know, did you see at Ormond, is it Ormond or Orbond?
He had Viktor Orban, yes.
Yeah. He wants to be a dictator. And this is what the United States is getting into. By if they elect him, are they crazy?
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Daryl in Toronto, who phoned about the recent time change back to daylight saving time.
I would like to know what the similar statistics are for every Tuesday after a holiday long weekend, because I would think that they're probably just as bad, if not worse. I don't think people get more sleep on a holiday weekend, and I don't think anyone's going to want to get rid of holiday weekends.
That does it for today's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at Fightback Libby and call our Fightback voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again at the same time tomorrow when we'll round up the rest of the Best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Zeev Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.